Welcome to Madang Podcast, hosted by Christian Century. Today's special guest is Dr. Reggie Williams, who is a professor of Christian ethics at McCormick Theological Seminary. He is the author of Bonhoeffer's Black Jesus, which was selected as a choice outstanding title in the field of religion. He is a member of the board of directors for the Society of Ethics, as well as the International Dietrich Bonhoeffer Society. So excited to have him today to discuss his book and his work. This recording was part of an event at the Southern Lights Conference, and this episode is co-hosted with Brian McLaren. Please stay tuned. Please join Homebrewed Christianity's online class, The Easter Stories, Celebrating, Questioning, and Exploring the Easter Stories. This is an open online class to anyone who is interested in the Easter stories. There will be 4 visual lectures, live Q&A, and an online community. Topics for this class include metaphors for Jesus' exaltation, Western tradition of individual resurrection, Eastern tradition of universal resurrection, and reconciliation of Eastern and Western resurrection traditions. This online class is taught by John Dominic Crossan and Trent Fuller. It is free, but donations are most welcome. Please join this wonderful online class.
Are you a community change maker? Are you a world-class faith leader? Then start your journey at McCormick Theological Seminary today. Learn more about our dynamic academic programs and faculty by visiting our website at mccormick.edu or by contacting our admissions department at admit@mccormick.edu today.
Discover the Black Madonna as a path to self-acceptance and transformation. Learn how you can co-create a spiritual experience with the Black Madonna. Join Dr. Christina Cleveland on March 14th for a free online event. You'll discover how the Black Madonna has always been there, ready to accompany you, guide you, and empower you as you move toward healing for your life and for our world. You can RSVP for free here at shiftnetwork.isrefer.com/go/bmgj/a25706/.
This is what happens because the Wild Goose Festival happens. Dreams are born, minds are changed, spirits rearranged, and people. People leave with eyes and arms open to the whole wide, aching world. Ready to make a difference. This is what happens because the Wild Goose Festival happens.
I'm going back to the Wild Goose Festival, which is happening July 13th to the 16th. Please join me at this fantastic event with preachers, speakers, musicians, and more. Use discount code MADANG to get $50 off your registration fee. That's a huge savings, $50 off by using discount code MADANG. You can order Dr. Reggie Williams' book and use discount code 17SPRING23 at BaylorPress.com for $20 off and free U.S. shipping from now through May 31st.
For sponsorship inquiries, please email madangpodcast@gmail.com. This is Madang, an outdoor living room for guests to share their experiences and their work. I invite you to come in and stay for a while.
I'll make a confession. I'm a fan of really stupid comedy. So, all those stupid movies, all those Will Ferrell movies and Dumb and Dumber and all those things. It's I don't know why, but I like them. And I listen to a lot of podcasts, and one of them is by Will Ferrell in the role of remember his show, the newsman and Anchorman, yeah. And so he has a podcast where he plays that role. And through the whole podcast, he doesn't really understand what a podcast is. He thinks he's on the radio and he can't quite figure out what a podcast is. But tonight, you all are going to get to witness the recording of a couple of podcasts, which is really kind of fun. And this podcast is tonight is hosted by Grace Jisun Kim. And before I introduce her, I also wanted to just take a minute to say that we have Peter and Kathy McCall here. Where are they? Here they are, right here. And Peter and Kathy were leading Southern Lights, and they were generous enough to help Southern Lights continue. I'm sorry, they were leading a January Adventure and were generous enough to help Southern Lights get born and continue. So we really want to thank you all for being here. Thank you. We're so glad you're here. And you're all, obviously, you're always so, we're so happy to see you. And several people asked about the original founder of January Adventure, Buzzy Pickren. And I don't know anything recent about Buzzy, except probably just to say that he's up there in years and he's very, very frail. That's the last I heard. And so he wouldn't be in a position anymore to come and be part of this with us. He was here a couple of years ago, the last right before COVID he was here. And he, you could tell he'd already gotten very frail, but we're so grateful. And many of you remember him, and none of us would be here if it weren't for his enthusiastic and energetic work. Grace Jisun Kim is just a hoot. She's just, you don't expect theologians to be fun, and you don't expect theologians to be funny, and maybe we should, but so many have given us another impression. Grace Jisun Kim is a Presbyterian pastor. She's a theologian. She's a professor at Earlham School of Religion. She's the host of the Madang podcast, hosted by Christian Century. And it's one of the podcasts I just love, and I hope you will check it out. And if you don't know what a podcast is, you'll have a better idea after tonight. I just want to say there are three of her books here that are just lovely and wonderful and insightful. One is Invisible: Theology and the Experience of Asian American Women. And you might think this is a book for Asian American women, but this is a book for all of us here. All of us here would benefit from this book as a way of understanding a slice of life and a perspective on life that Asian American women have to offer us in this country, in this world at this time. And it's beautifully written, and parts of it are touching and make me angry a little bit when I read them, in the sense of realizing things that happen in our world. It's a beautiful book. Healing Our Broken Humanity is such a powerful book, Practices for Revitalizing the Church and Renewing the World, that I understand the Episcopal Education for Ministry, now this is one of their books that they have people read. Highly, highly recommend Healing Our Broken Humanity. And the Homebrewed Christianity Guide to the Holy Spirit, Handraisers, Han, and the Holy Ghost. And all I can tell you is I love this book for so many reasons, one of which is Grace brings her Asian identity and heritage as I don't know if we say Korean American because you were Korean Canadian originally, but she brings deep traditions from her heritage and lineage into conversation with Christian theology, and it's very, very rich and very good, and also fun and just a joy to read. I should also say one other thing about Grace before I turn it over to her. Not the same year, but Grace, by far, but Grace and I were born on the same day. So, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. May the 4th be with you.
Yes. May the 4th be with you. Are you serious?
Yeah, so let's welcome Grace.
Thank you so much for the introduction. And I didn't pay him to advertise my books, but thank you so much. I'll send the check later. Wow, May 4th, that's exciting. I am much, much younger than Brian. I said that one time, and then you see, you guys are sitting really far away. And then when you come up close, either to talk or sign a book, then they all see my gray hair and they know I'm all lying. I'm not much younger. So anyway, thank you so much, Brian. And thank you, Diana, both of you for inviting me to this space. My podcast is called Madang. And you're probably wondering, what in the world is Madang? So to backtrack to tell you how I started, I can't remember the year now. About 3 years ago, I was going to start a podcast, and I was Googling all these names on the internet to make sure my name will be unique. So I had come up with a name, and it was an English name. And then a week later, I got really ill. And then I was hospitalized. So I totally forgot about it. And then 6 months later, I was talking to Diana, and I said, you know, would you be my guest again? Because 6 months ago, she said she was going to be my guest. And then she said, sure, sure. And I said, really? And she said, yeah. And then I said, okay. And then I could not remember the name I had come up with. I racked my brain. I couldn't remember. I knew it was a really good name, but I couldn't remember. And then I said I was going to interview you in 3 days, and I had no idea how to even do a podcast. I just thought it'd be a really easy, you know, I thought it'd be so easy. And Tripp, where are you? Tripp was here somewhere. He's somewhere, and he's going to go after me. But I've been on Tripp's podcast so many times, and he makes it so easy. And it was actually through his podcast. I don't know if you know the American Church in Paris. Does anyone know that church? How do you guys all know that church? Anyway, you were there. Yeah. They invited me to be one of, what was that scholar thing?
Thurber Lecture.
Oh, Thurber Lecture. He knows it better than me. And then I was so excited. I've never been to Paris. They said I can bring my family. So two of my three kids ended up going with me. So I went there and I said, how in the world did you even invite me? This was about 5 or 6 years ago. And they said, we loved you on Homebird Christianity. So I told this to Tripp on another interview that I was doing. And he said, well, why did they invite me? And I said, I don't know. So anyway, I'm so grateful to Tripp because he made it seem so easy. So anyway, 3 days I scrambled. So the name I came up with is a Korean name. Are there any Koreans here? Are there any Asians here? One? All right. Do you know what a madang is? Probably not. It's okay. Yeah. Okay, Chinese, yeah. So madang, okay. Who has been to Korea? Why so many people have been to Korea? Thank you for visiting my home country. So have you been to a traditional Korean home?
Yes.
house. Okay, so in a traditional Korean house, there's a gate. It's usually metal with maybe stones around it, and you open it. And then when you enter, do you know what that place is called? Yeah, everyone say it together.
Madang.
Yeah, and everyone subscribe to Madang. I'm just kidding. I don't get money for it, so anyway, you can subscribe anyway. No, but get the books first, and then you can subscribe. So Madang, who watches K-drama? Yeah, K-drama, you have to watch K-drama. So tonight when you go back to your room, you can start watching K-drama. But many K-dramas, so you enter the traditional home, that place, it's usually like a dirt, because traditionally we didn't have much grass. So there's usually a small table, and people sat in that madang. So on a hot summer day, you sat there and you ate, you slept, you took naps, and then you gossiped there. So it's like an outdoor living room because the homes were really small. So I remember my grandmother's house, there was only two rooms and then the kitchen, eight children. Yeah, so that's why you need that madang. So people go there and the neighbors come, there's nowhere else. So you sit in the madang and you talk. So I came up with this name and I thought, I must be a genius. I told my two boys and they said, Mom, that's not good. But my daughter, who I trust more, she said, Mom, you are a genius. So that's how Madang started. I think I started 2 years ago. And Brian has been on it and Diana Butler-Bass and a whole bunch of other famous and important people. And now today we have Dr. Reggie Williams. So I'm so, what did you do?
No.
You know what, because I almost forgot your last name.
I could tell.
What was that?
I can, nothing.
You can tell, I know. I am so bad with names, so that's why I know one of the assistants who's going around and he promised to take nice pictures of me.
We didn't just meet, by
the
way.
I know. But you're lucky I got your first name right.
Right.
Because I have friends.
Right.
And you know them too. One is a Henry and one is a Frank. And I get them mixed up all the time.
Yeah.
And you know who they are.
You're right.
Yeah. So you're lucky I got your first name right.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
But there is a... one of the workers here, his name is either Devin or Devi. Devin. Okay, yeah. So he promised to take nice pictures of me, but I couldn't remember his name, so he just said, call me Dev. I think that's what he said now, but I can't remember what he said. Okay, anyway, I don't know, this time, is that how much I have done?
Yep.
So I only have 20 minutes left?
You have 35 minutes.
Oh my goodness. Okay, well, Tripp, I'm going to run into your time a bit. Because he does a million of these, so it's not that important for him. I don't do that many. But I thought we were going to have some music, so everyone's going to be all into the mood, but there's no music. So I thought I was... Then they said, I am the music. So I'm just warming you guys up. So one more warm-up is, how many are here for the first time?
Wow.
Oh my goodness! Wow!
Wow.
How many came because you wanted to meet me? Thank you. Free books for everyone, right? No, I thought you were all like returnees. Wow, I thought that's what it was.
It's you. It's you.
Oh, I know. Thank you so much.
You're a genius. You're a genius.
I am a hoot. I didn't think that's what you were going to say to describe me, but yeah, that I'm a hoot. But anyway, it's so exciting. How many of you have been here for every single one? Stand up. There's a few of you. Let's clap for them. Okay, how many of you are going to come back next year? All right. Woo! Okay, I'm running out of time. Okay, so now we got to get to the good thing. So I am so excited to have Reggie and Brian. Okay, who was at Tripp's Homebrewed Christian, Theology Beer Camp? I know some of you because you approached me. Okay, you can go. And that time I had a horrible time because I had some beer before the panel. But then tonight I didn't have anything, and this is just me. So you can imagine what happened when I had the beer. Okay, so Brian is going to be my co-host tonight. So I'm so excited to be with you, Reggie, because we have been friends for a long time. But I never read his book. Until I had to read his book.
It's all right. That's okay.
It's okay, yeah.
That's because okay.
You know
that's
what? Right. I am sure Reggie didn't read my books either, so that's fine, right?
I wasn't going to say it.
Okay, you have to go buy my books now. So I didn't read it until I had to. But I was really excited after I read it. I thought, when it came out, I didn't know what the hype was about. But then now that I read it, it was so intriguing. Because you're one of the first like black theologian to kind of study Bonhoeffer. And I wasn't here for this morning's talk, your talk. And they sent me the video to watch it because I really wanted to watch it so I don't overlap so much of what he talked about. But we went nonstop all day, so I didn't have a chance. So some of these questions were overlap, but these are the questions I came up with because I was so intrigued because I have always loved Bonhoeffer. And I was teaching a class this week and I said, you know, those people that you really loved, like there might be Paul Tillich or some of these other major like Jean Vanier, and then after you read them, there is something, oh, that they did, and it just breaks your whole image of them, right? You know who I'm talking about. There are several of those readers, I mean, those writers. But so far, nothing about Bonhoeffer that we know of. But how did you get into studying Bonhoeffer?
Well, my buddy Grace here, I've been watching the development of your podcast and wondering when I'm going, when do I get my invitation? I'm glad to be here.
It costs money, it's not free.
Oh, yeah. So I would say actually there are black theologians before me who studied Bonhoeffer and who maybe even written a little bit about Bonhoeffer. James Cone won. And then Josiah Ulysses Young wrote a book on Bonhoeffer. He did it differently than what I did. Josiah Young wrote a book a while back called No Difference in the Fair, in which he was looking at Bonhoeffer's theology and the possibility of it speaking in an anti-racist language. That if you read Bonhoeffer, Bonhoeffer can help to understand why you should not be racist as a Christian, or how he can help with the problem of racism. Mine is doing it differently. So Josiah and I really are the black scholars who've written like full texts on Bonhoeffer. Mm-hmm. Mine is biographical, looking at why he was very early in the push against Bonhoeffer, kind of a chronological, biographical engagement with him. So there's that, and that actually speaks to what piqued my interest in him as well. When I was in my first year as a PhD student studying under Glenn Stassen at Fuller Theological Seminary, Glenn said that I might be interested, I mean, he just volunteered my interest for me, I might be interested in reading Dietrich Bonhoeffer with him. In fact, why don't you TA for me in this next class that I teach? And he's my, you know, he's my mentor, doctor father. Of course, I'm going to do what he says. It's going to grade me. So in the course of TAing for him, while I was TAing for him, I came across a couple of things. The first, Glenn was insistent that Bonhoeffer gained his insight on the problem of Nazism well before anybody else did, because he spent time in Harlem at a black church, at a Baptist church. Glenn made that, and he was in a conversation about a statement Dietrich made in prison to his best friend Eberhard Bethge. In this one of these prison letters in 1943, Bonhoeffer says to Bethge, "I haven't changed much in my life, except under two circumstances. One, the first influence is a father's personality." His dad was a really strong personality and the head of a psychological wing of a hospital in Berlin. Lead psychologist from Berlin, very important person. "Under the first influence is a father's personality, and after my first trip abroad," he says, "it was then that I changed from the phraseological to the real." Translate that from the abstract to the concrete. So the conversation was about, which trip abroad is he talking about? Is he talking about when he was an undergrad and he went to Europe, went to Rome with his older brother, short excursion to Africa, didn't tell their parents? Or was it when he went to New York, into the United States as a postdoc student? Glenn said, of course it was when he went to New York. And then a few other scholars agreed with him. My text is taking that argument and unpacking it. And I'm pretty certain I'm right.
Wow, thank you. So before you ask your question, I wanted to just continue on about racism. So racism, those who came into the minister kind of group with me and Brian after lunch, I told the group, I was born in Korea, I grew up in Canada, and then I moved to the U.S. about 15 or 20 years ago. But when I was growing up in Canada, so much racism. You know, I remember kids making fun of me in kindergarten, grade 1, 2, 3, all the way up, making fun. And in Canada, we didn't call people like me a person of color. Do you know what they called people like me? Okay, so I told the other group, and they may be here, but it's fine. So the term that they called people like me was the visible minority. So we visibly looked different from the white dominant society. And that was everybody, black and Asian, Hispanic, Native American. And then when I came to the U.S., you know, all of a sudden, overnight, I became a woman of color. And it was hard for me to get used to that term, but I don't know which term is better than the other. So here in the U.S., because racism is talked about in black and white terms, is that problematic when you study Bonhoeffer or when you do your Christian ethics or theology, or is it okay?
Well, okay is not a word that I would use when talking about any racism at all, but the black and white has a history here for helping to understand human difference as it's created in Europe. That's the category we're in. They're the poles. In order to have the other spectrums on the pole, you got to have the apex and the nadir. This is what that is mean. That's what that's doing. Now there's a time when there was a turn towards using multiculturalism or appreciating multiculturalism, which then would give attention to the other colors on the spectrum. That move itself is anti-black also. Why? Because it takes attention away from the originator of the color spectrum, the apex, white, the ideal. That is the source of the whole thing. Multiculturalism says everybody else against black, everybody else other than black. So we don't want to just be lumped together with black. We want to be away from black so everybody can see us. But you're still a part of a structure that is meant to assemble white as the ideal. So yes, the white and black are the categories that are used in this conversation. But the point is not so much to see, to have ourselves be made visible on this structure, on this spectrum. Really, we should be working to see ourselves otherwise.
Thank you.
You know, I was thinking as I heard you speak this morning, Reggie, I was born in 1956. So, and I heard about World War II and I heard about Nazism and I heard about the Holocaust, I don't know, when I was 8 or 9 or 10 years old. And by that time, for me as a white kid growing up, white Christian kid, what it did is it reinforced how we were the good guys and the Nazis were the bad guys. And when you suggested that Bonhoeffer's sensitivity to the ugliness going on in Germany was in some ways triggered or intensified by his experience in the United States of seeing white racism here, this feeling sort of rushes over me of, gosh, it didn't take very long for whiteness to find a new way to make itself the hero. And it's one of the reasons I'm so happy that this work is out in the world, because white people need to see how tricky whiteness is to evade exposure.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, I talk about the Holocaust in Nazi Germany most of the time because it's a thing that, I say this lightly, that most people agree was awful.
Yeah.
I say most.
Yeah.
Because we were in a time of a resurgence right now that's really awful.
Yeah.
Where that's being blurred. It's being, you know, that time is being, it's really dubious as to how many of us really still recognize that was awful. But that becomes ground where we can have a conversation about how bad racism is when we look at Europe and Nazi Europe. However, I don't need to go across the pond. You don't need to go across the Atlantic Ocean. We have stories right here on this soil here, literally, that we can refer to. But in doing that, looking across the Atlantic Ocean, you also come to recognize that this morning when I talked about the Nuremberg Laws and the unveiling of the Nuremberg Laws in 1935, I can't remember the author's name, but the book is titled Hitler's American Model. They didn't just put those together the night before they unveiled them. Hitler's American Model, written by a lawyer at Yale Law School, demonstrates how the Nazis studied before assembling the Nuremberg Laws. And guess who they studied? You can guess who they studied. They studied this country. Apartheid South Africa studied both Nazi Germany and the United States when they assembled theirs. None of those folks reinvented the wheel.
Okay. So in your book, you talk about Bonhoeffer. For him, Christianity centers totally on Jesus. So Christianity centers totally on Jesus. So for me, I struggle with who is Jesus? And for me, I'm in the middle of my 2-week intensive course on interfaith dialogue. And, you know, I've been teaching it for a long time and I struggle. So always Jesus has become the problem for me. Mm-hmm. So that's why I moved into the spirit. So as Brian mentioned, I use chi, the Asian term chi. So my question to you is, who is Jesus? Because, you know, when you study world religions, so Buddha was around before Jesus was born. And those who know Buddhism and Christianity and Hinduism and all these major world religions, some people will say everything that Jesus taught, Buddha already taught. Has anyone heard that before? Yeah. And then so this week, I just out of the blue decided to ask my students. So we in the New Testament passages, we have Jesus as, you know, he's conceived, he's born, and then they flee to Egypt, they come back and he's a little kid, and then nothing until he hits 30. So we wonder, what did Jesus do all that time? So one person gave a phenomenal kind of reason or an idea. And then I said, well, some people say that he went into the desert to study Buddhism. But anyway, we don't know. So always this question of Jesus, and you talk about the black Jesus. So can you share with us today? Because I'm sure some of us sitting here are struggling with who Jesus is, as we've struggled in the last 2,000 years of Christianity. It's an ongoing struggle. Who is Jesus? Who are we worshiping? Who, you know, who is God? Those are big questions. So anyway, how do you see Jesus?
Yeah. Yeah, this is, for all of you who didn't know, Dr. Grace Ji-Sung Kim, this is Grace Ji-Sung Kim. Let's talk about a little light conversation here. We got about 5 minutes. Who is Jesus? Okay. Never mind the fact that there are like thousands of books and whole fields of study here that are wrestling with this question. Oh, mine in 2 minutes. So, my ancestors said that Jesus is a doctor in the sick room, a lawyer in the courtroom, a brother to the brotherless, a mother to the motherless, a father to the fatherless. Jesus is my all in all. When white folks would say they are master, we know that they're lying, because Jesus. God was with Jesus on the cross. God is with us in suffering. And because of that, in the suffering, we know that Sunday's coming. That's who Jesus is. Jesus is the reason why Saturday is not without hope. And Sunday isn't the last word. So there's this deep confessional relationship with Jesus. I get a little choked up when I think about this, because I know there are a lot of people here who are hanging on to their faith by the skin of their teeth. And I think that speaks to the role, I guess, that Jesus may have with and for us too. Jesus doesn't provide, and here I'm speaking as somebody who, for whom Jesus is very important to me, he doesn't provide the certainty. Jesus is the reason for faith, not certainty. And there's a difference. The opposite of faith is not doubt, but certainty. And Jesus provides that faith for me, and I hope for you too. Now, to speak in a Bonhoefferian language, Jesus is reality, the shape of reality since the incarnation. So there's a bit of jargon there. Jesus is God's revelation to the world of God's self. There's this. Now, Jesus is also us for us. He is vicarious representation. meaning that he is God's revelation to the world of who God is, but he's also your encounter with every human being, because God in Christ, or Christ stands in before us before God. What does that mean? We in our sin and shame can't stand before God. Christ stands in for us before God, but also before each and every one of us. Literally, you don't meet another person without an encounter with Christ. That's the shape of reality since the incarnation. So that's Bonhoeffer on who Jesus is. The church is who Jesus is. Jesus, gosh, I could keep going on here. I mean, okay, so you ask a Baptist who Jesus is, and you give me 2 minutes.
Well, let me press further, because for me, a lot of my work has been deconstructing Christianity and theology. So, you know, Mary Daly, what's her famous quote? Who said that?
God is what?
Yeah, great. Thank you. If God is male, then the male is God.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's her famous quote. I want to be remembered for a famous quote, but that hasn't come to me yet. I'm not that famous. But that's what I want, that you ask a question and somebody knows. So, you know, we are, language is so important. So, you know, much of us, we've grown up with a white male God, and many of us are running away from the white male God. So for me, I had a white male Jesus. I had that Solomon's image. You know that one that I'm referring to?
Born of Solomon's head of Christ.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So that head of Christ, we grew up really poor. My family, we were immigrants, two bedroom. We had cockroaches everywhere. My parents didn't have any new furniture. One day my dad brings home this head of Christ picture, and my mom thought it was the real head of Christ, right? It was the most important thing in our two-bedroom apartment. And she put it right above the couch, and I grew up with that, so it was a white male Jesus. And then in my seminary years, I was chosen to go to India. And what do I see in India?
The same head of...
It's every... this thing is everywhere. Right? This whiteness of Jesus. So my question to you is Jesus black? Or does it make a difference?
Yes.
Okay, it makes so a tell difference. Us.
Makes a difference. Two things. First of all, this whole, the interaction with gender and with race and with class and with sexuality, these all point to the genre of humanity that we are addressing in the West. So I'm talking about human. I'm talking about not just, I'm not the word for the world here. We are dealing with a genre. A really well-known scholar of blackness studies, Sylvia Winter, says genre. The European concept of man has become human for the world, overrepresented as human for the world. That is a genre. All of that is attached to him. And white Christ is a sacred license, sacred representation of that genre. So that's important to recognize. We're not talking about an incarnational Jesus. You're not talking about Jesus, you know, as you might say, this the French, you know, understand God in their context. Nothing like that. We're talking about white Jesus here. And to say that Jesus is black is to say a couple of things. As I said this morning, one is to say that Jesus knows suffering. Jesus is representative, and I might start this actually with reference to Howard Thurman. Many of you know where I'm going with this. And when he wrote his book, Jesus and the Disinherited, he was responding to an accusation that he was a traitor by being a Christian. He was responding to a Hindu man's claim that you're a traitor as a man of color by being a Christian. Don't you know they had a slave ship named Jesus? This is what the man tells Thurman. So he writes this text. And he says that Jesus is Jew. He's poor Jew. He's poor Jew in a colonized state. As such, he knew the experience historically of those who have their backs pressed against the wall by politically oppressive regimes throughout history, who have had their backs pressed against the wall. Jesus, if this is his context, his understanding, his experience in the world, who are those people in the United States today? This makes Jesus black. That's what he's referring to. On one hand, the experience of the people who know they know what it's like to have their backs pressed against the wall by politically oppressive regimes. The country and the political structures are not on their side. That's what he means. This is what Cone meant when he wrote Black Theology and Black Power. He was saying that the Black Power movement is a theological movement. Why? Because it's pushing back against suffering, empowering people in the context of suffering. Jesus, God is black. He said, God is black, baby, here in the United States. And it's not pulling him, as it were, ontologically into the structures of race that are created by white supremacy. It's pulling him into the experiential, the political experience of a demographic harmed by oppression. Okay, and then the other one that I would say, I made reference to this too. Black as complete and holy otherness. Borrow a little bit from Karl Barth here. Infinitely, qualitatively other. Outside of the efforts to be regulated by systems of knowledge that give us human difference. So to say it in this way, you know the world, you know human difference based on race and gender and sexuality. This is the way we know what it means to be human. Black is other than that, outside of that. To try and control that knowledge is to try to catch the ocean in a Dixie cup. It can't be caught, captured, regulated. It is outside of that knowledge. It offers us another way of seeing and thinking. That is another way of saying Jesus is black. And we could spend some time talking about that.
You know, as you're saying that, I'm just thinking, here we're having this conversation in the state of Georgia, very close to the state of Florida. And, you know, if we were to just go start knocking on doors, I think what we'd find is if that physical painting of Christ, white Jesus, is not on the actual wall, the image is stamped on people's brains. And I suppose it just strikes me that how important this conversation is, that we don't let Christianity move forward with white Jesus without it being challenged. Now, we know that people are going to fight tooth and nail to keep it going, and we can't de-stamp their brains.
Yeah.
But if nobody ever speaks up with an alternative vision, I beg to differ.
Right.
That's not my Jesus, you know. I think we miss our opportunity. And I'm just thinking, you know, both in the academy, but also in the church, you really, both of you are challenging that white Jesus. And it just strikes me how important that is. And I'd love to know just where you think we are in the struggle and how is it going?
In the struggle against
the white Jesus.
White Jesus. Ooh, yikes. Well, I think we are, you know, I find hope at times in the presence of other people who are fed up.
Yeah.
Who are tired, who want to struggle, but find it challenging to keep struggling.
Yeah.
When we find each other, we find hope.
Yeah.
You're tired too.
Yeah.
I know I am. Mm. We lean on each other for a moment. Mm. You know, there's places like this. How it's going in a bigger, broader picture, that's tough to say. It's really tough to say. I think we're finding some backwards movement. I think the opponents got some wind under their wings recently, and they found courage to fight like hell against everything that would keep Mayberry from a realization. Yeah. You know, when you're talking about white Jesus, you're talking about not just a picture, you're talking about an internal structure in their minds of what reality should be. I get nervous around Christians who speak a lot of really Christian-y language. When they know that I teach at a seminary, or they know that I'm ordained or so, and they say, oh, I'm Christian too. It's not an immediate good news for me. It's not immediate good news. I need to know what kind of Christian you are. I may not want to sit next to you on a plane. So that's the struggle for me.
You know, I this is probably bad form to try to answer a question I ask, but as soon as I asked the question, a thought hit me, hadn't hit me in this way. You know, a lot of us are complaining about how many people are leaving church.
Yeah.
But we could say, thank God these people are leaving white Jesus.
Right.
Thank God they didn't stay to keep supporting white Jesus. You know?
Right.
Yeah, because this whiteness is a problem in our society.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, you know, moving away from the white Jesus, because Jesus was never white, but then he became white. Yeah.
Sure.
And you see the whiteness of Jesus, you know, becoming whiter and whiter as the church develops.
Yeah.
And it's used as a tool to oppress.
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, the topics that you cover are so interesting. So this, you know, the racism is key. But then when I co-wrote a book called Intersectional Theology. Mm. With Dr. Susan Shaw, who teaches at Oregon State University. She's a white lesbian professor. So for us to think about intersectionality was so important as we do theology too. So here, you know, racism is a problem, but what about the gender issue, class issue, ableism? What are we going to do with these problems? Because they do intersect and they continue to oppress people and, you know, people of color and women of color.
Right.
And with ableism.
So true. That's why I talk about genre. Uh-huh. You must be talking about the genre. You can't talk about any one particular issue alone. This is one of the things that intersectionality teaches us. For those of us who will want to harp on racism as a problem, but stay silent about sexism, classism, so forth, you end up doubling down on those things. Those people become invisible. That kind of, those parts of a person's oppressed identity become invisible. They suffer more because you're wanting to focus on gender alone. This is one of the things in her book, classic text, White Women's Christ, Black Women's Jesus. Jackie Grant talks about, she makes mention of the gender struggle. The white feminists in the 70s said that the civil rights proponents in the 60s were sexist. Mm-hmm. They were sexist. And so they spoke negatively of the civil rights movement and of those civil rights leaders. Jackie Grant says, well, they didn't pay attention to their racism. The white feminists didn't. And the womanists come along in the 1980s, womanist appropriating a term used by Alice Walker for developing characters in her stories. And, you know, Color Purple is a classic womanist text. Womanist theologians come along and they help us to see within the theological world, multiple intersecting oppressed identities. If you're going to stand on the side of justice, you need to be able to see in at least three dimensions here, the problem of oppression. Not just one level of analysis alone, because you end up doubling down on the other aspects of a person's oppressed identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm glad that you can, you know, I think that's so important today, you know, with when Trump and then, you know, all these things were happening, the Women's March, you know, everyone was talking about intersectionality. And so I think this is a key thing that we need to continue to work in theology and also in the church, because, you know, women are getting ordained, but still we exist in male spaces. And then that white male God still exists in the church, and to kind of dismantle that is so much work. There is so much resistance. So when we think about evil in our society, how do we resist evil in our society?
Ooh.
I know we're going to run out of time.
Oh, yeah.
So,
And this is another one of those simple Grace G. Sung Kim questions. How do we resist evil in our society? I think it's one quick answer to that, actually. I think that's too much to try and do. I don't think we want to resist evil in our society. I think we want to live into the call God has on your life to love your neighbor as yourself. That's what I think we should be doing. And that is a struggle enough. Yeah.
Do you have a last minute question?
Well, I think our that's a good, great place to stop.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Reggie Williams, for coming on Madang. And thank you so much, Brian, for co-hosting with me. And thank you so much for all listening. Let's give a round of applause for Reggie.
Please join Homebrewed Christianity's online class, The Easter Stories, Celebrating, Questioning, and Exploring the Easter Stories. This is an open online class to anyone who is interested in the Easter Stories. There will be 4 visual lectures, live Q&A, and an online community. Topics for this class include metaphors for Jesus' exaltation, Western tradition of individual resurrection, Eastern tradition of universal resurrection, and reconciliation of Eastern and Western resurrection traditions. This online class is taught by John Dominic Crossan and Trip Fuller. It is free, but donations are most welcome. Please join this wonderful online class.
Are you a community change maker? Are you a world-class faith leader? Then start your journey at McCormick Theological Seminary today. Learn more about our dynamic academic programs and faculty by visiting our website at mccormick.edu or by contacting our admissions department at admit@mccormick.edu today.
Discover the Black Madonna as a path to self-acceptance and transformation. Learn how you can co-create a spiritual experience with the Black Madonna. Join Dr. Christina Cleveland on March 14th for a free online event. You'll discover how the Black Madonna has always been there, ready to accompany you, guide you, and empower you as you move toward healing for your life and for our world. You can RSVP for free here at shiftnetwork.isrefer.com/go/bmgj/a25706/.
This is what happens because the Wild Goose Festival happens. Dreams are born, minds are changed, spirits rearranged. And people leave with eyes and arms open to the whole wide, aching world, ready to make a difference. This is is what happens because the Wild Goose Festival happens.
I'm going back to the Wild Goose Festival, which is happening July 13th to the 16th. Please join me at this fantastic event with preachers, speakers, musicians, and more. Use discount code MADANG to get $50 off your registration fee. That's a huge savings, $50 off by using discount code MADANG. You can order Dr. Reggie Williams' book and use discount code 17SPRING23 at BaylorPress.com for $20 off and free U.S. shipping from now through May 31st.
For sponsorship inquiries, please email madangpodcast@gmail.com.